take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
I do feel a little bit like you're William Buckley and I'm Gore Vidal, to be sitting in chairs like this and conversing.
Is that right? I don't feel like I drink enough to be William Buckley.
Keep applying yourself.
Plus, I could never pass as a patrician.
That's true.
You on the other hand.
That's true.
You on the other hand.
Yeah, I could be a patrician? I don't know. If you just binge listen to the podcast, like, you might have heard, like, Mike Bronx... My parents' Bronx accent still lives within me and comes out sometimes.
It's just like a little flavor.
Yeah, it's a little flavor.
It's a little flavor.
It's a little paprika.
Yeah, exactly. Even more, I think you would. I would notice if it was missing. No, it was nice. It's a New York...
Yeah.
It's a global story, but it's a New York story.
Yeah.
And it's nice to have a New Yorker narrating it.
Thank you.
And telling that story.
Thank you.
What I really love about... the scope of the podcast. Mm. First off, it is both global and personal.
Mm-hmm.
You start out with a very personal anecdote.
Yeah.
You're just a fabulous storyteller. And then you bring it back. But, I mean, 9/11 for everybody is personal, mm-hmm. at least people of our age. But you also manage to frame it in sort of a global context of history.
Mm.
Could you talk a little bit about your approach to this story and what the story, how the story evolved for you?
Sure, just free associating. So it's personal and it's global history, right? So probably the thing that I just hadn't registered with me prior was this scene in 1945 when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt has just been to the Yalta Conference in Europe and basically carving up a large part of the world with the other great powers, right, after World War II. And it's the heart of the American century. And the president makes a pit stop on his way back to America in Saudi Arabia, this desert kingdom that didn't exist as a unified state like 15 years earlier. So why would the most powerful man in the world stop in this little corner of the Arabian Peninsula? And of course we know why now, because...
Well, because you told us.
Yes. The original deal between the United States and Saudi Arabia is worked out on the deck of a Navy destroyer in, I think... was it the Red Sea or the Gulf of Oman? Between
with Persian carpets on the deck. I love that detail.
Yep, Persian carpets on the deck. The royal family is there, or at least the males from the royal family are all there. And they shake hands, King Saud, and FDR, and they make this deal that U.S. gets the first crack at this ocean of crude beneath the Saudi desert, and in return, Saudi Arabia, this upstart state, gets the military protection of the world's superpower, the world's most dominant superpower. And how this, to a guy like an Islamic fundamentalist like Osama bin Laden, who hadn't been born yet, he would be born in 1957, but this is blasphemous, this arrangement, that Saudi Arabia, the heart of Islam, where Mecca, Medina, and the holy cities are, and where the Prophet Muhammad strode on the earth, that this is now a client state to the United States, which bin Laden considered an infidel power.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the most, the infidelist.
Yeah, the most infidel of the infidel powers. And this, from the very beginning, was Osama bin Laden's objection, and strenuous objection, which is both religious and, even more importantly, political. Osama bin Laden, we take pains to point out, had a political agenda,
mm-hmm.
and so did the jihadists who were in his orbit. Yes, they objected to the West's cultural style, but primarily and fundamentally, they objected to American foreign policy, to the secular leaders of Muslim countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, to the governments that they found insufficiently Islamic. And that's the prime moving factor of this, what turned out to be this implacable enemy of America and the West.
You start out saying we could begin with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire.
In 1923,
after the First World War.
So you have the Ottoman Empire, which is, you know, essentially a Muslim state, and it has this vast swath of territory in the Middle East and Europe.
But very tolerant.
I don't know that much about it. I suppose that at certain periods it might have been. But, yeah, like you're right. At the end of World War One, the Western powers carve it up
mm-hmm.
into nation states. Not always drawing these countries' borders, not always logically, or sometimes disastrously. So after World War One, you have the rise of the Western powers, led by the United States, which takes this vast lead in technology, in military prowess, in global political alliances, and becomes the sort of leading power in the world. And so all of these Arab states have been reduced to, for the most part, small struggling countries, the exception being when the oil boom starts happening in Saudi Arabia and then later in surrounding countries. And that is the, you know, a breeding ground of resentment among many among some in those countries. And among them were Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who leads al-Qaeda to this day, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, mastermind of 9/11, Ramzi Youssef, mastermind of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. This is the fringe group of radical fundamentalists who felt that violence was the only way to begin redressing this imbalance of power. And what do the weak do when confronted with the strong? They turn to what weapon they have, and in this case, it's terrorism.
Mm.
In this case, it's a willingness to slaughter innocent civilians with all kinds of justifications on their part. But that's what you see. That's when the sides are drawn up, and that's when the tactics start emerging. And now we're talking about the late 1980s, early 1990s, when all of the jihadists have gathered in Pakistan and Afghanistan at the end of the Afghan war, and the Soviets have been defeated and go home, and now the jihadists who are committed to violent jihad look around and say, what can we do next?
Mm-hmm. You can't mention 9/11 without mentioning the Mujahideen and the CIA supporting the war against the Russians in Afghanistan. Mm. For the vast majority of Americans, do you assume that they don't know this backstory?
Well, you know, 9/11 is our Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's not as well known as Pearl Harbor in a strange way, or as high in the American consciousness as a major turning point in American history. I suppose that's debatable, but...
No, I agree. Why do you think that is? I mean, yeah, if you think about it, like 20 years after Pearl Harbor, right, 1961, right, there's nobody who doesn't know Pearl Harbor, what happened after. I mean, obviously, the World War and everything, but...
I think that's why. I think because Pearl Harbor was a clear strike from a nation state that brought the United States into a war that was then won. It's very conclusive and very clear what happened and what the result was and how the world changed. 9/11 was a sneak attack that has resulted in endless wars that still occur and have shown no sign of ever being resolved. If you take this concept of the war on terror or the wars on terror, they could go on indefinitely. So 9/11 is more nebulous and ambiguous and harder to get your arms around as a turning point, maybe not a turning point in history, because clearly it is, as it's a little harder to understand how it completely changed the world and everyday life. Because in a way, it's all around us. I compared it to, like, the radiation from the Big Bang. It's suffused everywhere. It affects every part of our lives, so we sort of don't see it. So I think the audience is people who lived through 9/11, who know the story of 9/11, or like me when I started, who think they know the story of 9/11, and who are going to be surprised if they listen to this podcast.
They're
going to
be surprised and delighted.
Thank you.
So let's go there. What did you think you knew about 9/11? Standing in Staten Island, trying to get stories from people, and just sitting there slack-jawed, dumbfounded, in shock as the plane flew overhead.
Yeah, so of course that puts me in the generation of people who were adults on 9/11. The other part of the audience is people, or younger people, who were born maybe afterward and know it merely as an abstraction or a footnote or a historical event.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would be interested in knowing the detailed lead up to 9/11.
Yeah, no, my kid had 8 months in the old world.
Yeah, right.
You know, and then that was it.
Yeah.
You know.
So
what did you think you know before you started researching this? And I mean, I see you have just a pile of books on your desk. And
yeah, this is just some of them.
You just, you know, you could tell you've just been devouring this stuff.
Yeah. I didn't know how much of it. Here, let me put it this way. So we compare the 11 years leading up to 9/11, which is the subject of the podcast, to a global chess game.
Mm-hmm.
And on one side, you have the jihadis making their moves. On the other side, you have American law enforcement, FBI, CIA making their moves. But first trying to figure out that the game is even being played.
Mm.
And then when they figure that out, who their opponent is and what their goal is. And all of these moves are being made in the shadows. It's kind of a shadow struggle that's going on up until the moment of checkmate, which occurs on 9/11. So much of that story I just didn't grasp about the all of the moves that were made on the streets of New York City.
Mm.
About there just so happens to be two mosques, one in Brooklyn and one in Jersey City, which for a time hosted these cells of extremists who plotted attacks against the United States, more or less in plain sight, you know, raised up the assassin Saeed Nosseir, who shot down extremist Rabbi Meir Kahane. Mm-hmm.
That's the initial, the first episode is the bullet.
Yes.
And Meir Kahane. Yeah, and I remember when that happened. I'm sure you remember when that happened as well.
Yeah, I do.
And we just went, you know.
It seemed like so, and more some craziness from the Middle East has spilled over into the streets of Manhattan.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Right.
You know?
And to this day, actually, I forgot that it wasn't a Jew who killed him, because the initial reports, in fact, mm-hmm. were Jews. But what's wild, reading, or not reading, but like listening to it, I feel like I'm reading, because I'm learning so much, it was that they used the openness of our society against us. And some of the peculiarities of American society, namely everybody gets a gun, to go and practice and shoot, and they would have these, they were literally training their own little militia, you know, like on Long Island, like Michigan's got their militias, and we had, you know, and they formed their own here.
Yeah, that's what I would say from researching this story. Beware of militias. Beware of private militias who are training with guns in remote locations or in shooting ranges, because there's a chance they'll be tempted to impose their will on American politics, with, in this case, an assassination. So this guy, Saeed Nosseir, he's a Muslim man who goes to talks by these veterans of the Afghan, by these veterans of the Afghan war, like Abdullah Azzam, who comes and preaches on the necessity of violent jihad against the West. The blind sheikh, who comes...
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. No.
Well, this is a different guy. This is the
Omar,
blind sheikh. Yeah, Abdel Omar Rahman, who preaches this sort of vituperative resentment against the United States and the West. Mm. And so Saeed Nosseir is turned around by this and decides that he is going to take matters into his own hands and shoot down this extremist rabbi, which he does at the Marriott Hotel in Manhattan in front of 100 of his followers, just in plain sight. Tries to escape, gets shot himself, and then goes to prison. But what seemed to be yet another strange spasm of violence, which was not that unusual in 1990 New York.
Well, that's the thing. New York is a perfect cover for that. Right?
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's like this. Of course, people are going to get shot and killed. And
yeah, extremist violence was fairly common in New York City in the 1990s, as we point out, because these separatist groups and these sectarian groups from around the world would come here and try to make a name for themselves or get their causes on the front pages and of America's...
Sure. Yeah, the Armenians bombing the Turks and the Turks doing this and everybody's...
So therefore, this assassination seems like just one more of those. One more of those one-offs.
Just random.
Random to our eyes, but obscure. Some obscure political feud is being played out on our streets or in our hotel, when in fact it's the first strike. It's the first move in the chess game. Mm-hmm. It's part of the gathering storm of jihadis, because who are out to attack the United States. Saeed Nosseir is part of this cell, based in a mosque in Brooklyn, that has been training with weapons, and his associates will then go on, while he goes to jail, they'll then go on to do the World Trade Center bombing in 1993.
Mm. You're listening to Foraging Ahead. I'm Kevin Factor, and this is my interview with Jim O'Grady, a journalist in print and radio. We're talking about his new podcast, Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11. In this next segment, Jim talks a little bit about the psychology and the makeup of assassins and terrorists and some of the motivations behind the major players that brought down the Twin Towers. This is not a humorous tale, but I really enjoyed your humorous commentary on some of the stupidity of the world's dumbest terrorist. I mean, it's against the backdrop of this horror.
Yeah.
I found it refreshing, but.
It's a little change of pace.
So
I'm glad you said that. You know, these are human beings on both sides. They screw up.
Exactly, and that's where this is different from like a made for TV movie or a TV drama. It would be sort of like, you know, the Keystone Cops if the end result wasn't so tragic.
Yeah.
And I mean you see the terrorist cells sort of like screwing up left and right, and the FBI and the CIA not talking, and these, you know, people not listening, and dealing with hierarchies. I mean, the way that I forget the woman's name who discovered that in fact Al-Qaeda is just like a bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And then once she had that framework, everything sort of fell into place.
Yeah.
And you realize, oh yeah, there's like, you know, accountants and other, you know, other departments in Al-Qaeda, and there's probably infighting and office politics going on in there as well.
It had a whole layer of middle management.
A whole layer of middle management and people failing up, you know. I'm going to get back to Nasser. And you said that all assassins have something in common,
mm-hmm.
and then you sort of make that connection with sort of the terrorism. And I think I'd like to explore that a little bit. If you feel like talking about that.
Sure. An assassin, a terrorist, is out to kill people, for sure. But their main goal is to change. Let me think of how best to put this.
Well, how about personally for the assassin? What kind of a person?
Yeah.
What is in the makeup of somebody who said, "Oh, this is something this is a good idea, or mm-hmm. this is what I need to do," like to kill this person or to blow this, you know, to blow up this building and kill thousands of people.
Mm-hmm. Assassins, first of all, are political actors. They're trying to create a spectacle of violence that changes some political equation. So that's what they're after. They're after theater. They want to shock and horrify us. But they also tend to be tortured personally, with the sense of being losers themselves in their lives, and they grasp this opportunity in their eyes to redeem themselves through this act of political violence that will change things for the better in their minds and make them celebrities among the people of their cause, who are behind their cause. And as I say in the story, it's an odd thing. Scholars who have studied assassins find that they don't always plan their escape very well.
Right.
Because it's like they almost can't think past their moment of glory. Or they've already decided they're just going to martyr themselves, you know? And so that's how assassins approach what they're going to do. Similar in many respects to what a terrorist does. They want to create something so horrible that it stops the world in its tracks and it makes everyone pay attention and to ask, what issue could be so important to have produced this carnage?
Mm.
That's what they want. And they want to then tell you what their issue is.
Mm-hmm. There are also, like a lot of the, it seems like the sort of the upper echelon in the sort of Al-Qaeda bureaucracy, you said, yeah, they were informed by this sort of vision of a pan-Islamic world.
Yeah.
Like, whatever that would look like.
The caliphate.
The caliphate.
Reborn.
But as you point out in the series, it's as much, if not more, sort of political
yeah.
than it is religious.
Yeah.
But the instruments that they deploy in pursuit of their political aims are fanatics.
Yeah. Yeah. They find people they can manipulate.
Yeah. Cynical.
Yeah. Into sacrificing their lives for the advancement of their politics.
Yeah.
Osama bin Laden wanted to rule Saudi Arabia, his home country.
Mm.
The blind sheikh, who is absolutely instrumental in the gestation of terrorism in New York City, he wanted to rule Egypt. They wanted to rule these countries as Islamic states. They wanted personal power.
Mm.
That drove them perhaps as much as anything else. They wanted power for themselves in these states. The model was in 1979 when the Shah of Iran takes advantage of the unrest in Iran, returns from exile in Paris to take over the country. Bin Laden saw that, the blind sheikh saw that, and thought, that's what we're going to do in our countries.
Mm-hmm.
So the blind sheikh, just as Paris was for the Ayatollah, Jersey City was the blind sheikh's Paris.
Mm.
So you might say, why? Why
well, he was blind.
Great point.
Sorry.
Yeah, you could just tell him.
There's yeah, there's like, hey, watch out for the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, the Arc de Jersey
yeah,
City. He came to the New York because it's where the money is.
Mm.
It's where the people were already forming into organized cells. And it's where he could get attention.
Mm-hmm.
For his cause. It didn't work out for him. He never became the ruler of Egypt, and nor did Osama bin Laden become the ruler of Saudi Arabia. But this is what drove them: politics and the pursuit of power for themselves, mixed with some deeply felt religious motivation. The one thing I found out is researching these major players in the jihadist movement that pulled off all of these series of terrorist attacks throughout the 1990s, culminating with 9/11, is each one of these major players had a different mix of motives. But mostly it was politics. Mostly it was objections to U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. It was objections to Israel. It was objections to the governments of Muslim countries, mixed with varying degrees of religious conviction. In Osama bin Laden, the religious conviction seems to have been authentic and strongly felt. With someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, he had almost no religious conviction at all, according to those who knew him. He just wanted mayhem against the West. There's sort of a cliche that the terrorist is a loser with nothing going for him, and so why not just throw your life away?
Mm.
That's not the case with these major jihadis. Many of them are educated. Many of them are from economically well-off families, middle class and above. In the case of Osama bin Laden, as we point out, his family's not only rich, it is Rockefeller rich. It is so rich, it comes with this sort of noblesse oblige idea that I am meant to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
I am meant to tell people how to live. And that was Osama bin Laden. These guys are not down and out scrabblers just looking to take their shot. These are people involved in a lifelong campaign of with political aims. So what was your question?
That was just an offhanded one on what, like, how does one family produce?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. So they came from different kinds of families, but for the most part, they were educated and well off.
Yeah. As was Osama bin Laden, as was Muhammad Atta, you know, as were all
the hijackers themselves, yeah.
Were there. But, and it just, it highlights just the chasm.
Unless it, come in.
So, there's so many angles that this podcast manages to integrate seamlessly into this story. Some of my favorites were back, like, from the American side. Now, we talked a lot about the Al-Qaeda and, like, the motivations and how just these seemingly educated, wealthy people who had everything that we could possibly think of anybody wanting, mm-hmm. not being satisfied, you know. But isn't it, like, often sort of educated middle class or upper middle class people who joined cults to begin with? I mean,
or even good causes, you know.
Or good causes, sure.
There's nothing wrong with idealism. Mm. It's the tools you use to realize your vision for a better world. Mm. And if those tools are violent and result in the deaths of innocent people, well, that makes you a terrorist. Mm. So it's not so much the impulse to change the world for the better by your own lights. And you can certainly disagree with these Islamic fundamentalists about what makes for a good life and a good world, but it's the way they went about it. And you can, you know, ask many Muslims who would say, no, this is not our way. These people are extremists. They do not represent us or our religion. It was interesting how Osama bin Laden, as he rose to in global stature, tried to pretend to speak for all Muslims. Mm. So that when he issued a declaration of war against America and the West, he called it a fatwa.
Right.
Even though he wasn't a cleric.
Right.
But he was arrogating that power. That,
but how do you get to be a Muslim cleric? I mean, is there a certification program or...
Yeah, like, it's a course of study, as I understand it.
Right. But there doesn't, there seems to be... I mean, it's not like the Catholic Church. Islam is just... in addition to having many different mm-hmm. sort of denominations, right? For
lack of There's nothing like the Catholic Church in, in its centralized monotheism. Yeah.
Or even the Eastern Orthodox Church, where you have, you know, there's no... It actually, Islam more closely resembles Judaism in a very decentralized structure. And imams are more akin to sort of rabbis. And the interpretations of Islam and are very wildly, you know, I always thought it was ironic that they used Iran as an example of how to, you know, harness religious fanaticism to overthrow a Western-backed government when they hated the Shia.
Yeah.
The knock on Islam is that the other world religions have not produced this sort of violence, at least in the last, you know, several hundred years.
Man, I think you can find religious fanatics in every tradition who have carried out assassinations and terrorist attacks. I mean, I'm not interested in comparing
true.
The fanatic slice of one religion versus another.
Right. So you don't buy that there's something inherent in Islam that produces...
No, not at all. Not remotely. Mm. Not at all. Mm. These people were extremists.
Yeah. No, I would say you do make it clear in the... You handle that with great care and thoughtfulness in the podcast. Yeah, no. I'm just being a jerk.
No. These are questions that people ask, and that ask people ask. And
in this next segment, we talk about the men and women who worked to stop the growing terrorist threat during the 1990s, when our attention as a nation was on other things, and the role of the FBI and the CIA, a little bit about producing the podcast, and the world, probably many people my age and Jim's age, would kind of like to return to, in some way, the 1990s. One of the slices that I really enjoyed was, you know, it's a thriller. It's a spy thriller. It's kind of James Bondy, but it's also like a buddy movie. Like, you've got these great pairs of cops.
Yeah.
You know, like trying to get the bad guys,
uh-huh,
and being foiled by the incompetent, like, bureaucrats and the higher ups and the paper pushers and all that.
Sometimes they succeed, mm-hmm, and sometimes they fail.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's good about the story. You'll be surprised.
And the informant.
Oh,
what an amazing story.
Yeah. Imad Salem, Egyptian immigrant, living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, former Egyptian Army colonel, who was there the day Anwar Sadat was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
He was there in uniform and swore in his heart to get revenge over the man who ordered that assassination, who, it turns out, was this imam, this fanatical imam called the Blind Sheikh, who, as we previously said, relocated to Jersey City.
Mm-hmm. Paris on the Hudson,
to further jihad in America. And Imad Salem is asked by the FBI to infiltrate the Blind Sheikh's cell. Well, first of all, they say to him, "Do you know who this guy is, the Blind Sheikh?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I know very well."
Mm. And it just lets you know how little we knew about this whole world.
Oh, yeah. This story of Imad Salem should be much better known than it is. I didn't know about it.
No, I didn't.
And in plunging into it, I was amazed at every turn, at the risks this man take, at the risks this guy took out of a mix of motives, like everyone else in the story. One, revenge against the Blind Sheikh. Two, just straightforward patriotic love of America.
Yeah, I think that was one of the wonderful things about hearing his story is, like, he has that unshakable faith in the American dream and what America has to offer, and he just eats it up, and he's just, you know, it's just almost the classic immigrant story.
Yeah. Except in this immigrant story, a guy goes undercover, has a gun put to his head at various times, comes so close to being found out by these guys.
I won't give any things away, but there's one scene in the kitchen
where he's
interviewing Omar. The Blind Sheikh. I was, like, squirming. That was great.
This guy has an incredibly cinematic life once he's asked by the FBI to go undercover.
Mm-hmm.
And the things he did are remarkable. So we were able to tell that story at length in the
podcast.
And
at one point he was just a security guard in the department store.
Well, that's the thing. It reminded me of an Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Mm.
They often begin with an ordinary person just doing an ordinary thing during an ordinary day.
Mm.
And then they meet someone or something happens where their life is just spun into a funhouse mirror. And then suddenly they're swallowed up by intrigue and drama and all of that. And that's what happens to Imad Salem. He's sort of the security guy at a dreary, or not dreary, but ordinary midtown Manhattan hotel, sitting at his desk on a regular day, and the intercom rings, and it's this FBI agent, Nancy Floyd, wants to have a little talk with him. And so from that moment on, his life completely changes.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes an espionage thriller.
Yeah. But you almost, they couldn't have designed a better mole.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Than this guy.
Oh yeah.
And he had all the skills.
Yep. Arabic speaker, understood the culture.
Electronics. He was like
surveillance.
Surveillance. Yep. Yeah. You know, you get a sense he probably did some pretty bad stuff in Egypt.
Yeah,
I mean, like,
well,
the way that we would judge. I mean, like, look, it's hard to be, you know, like.
He had the mindset. He had the temperament.
He had
the motivation.
Yeah, he had the motivation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He still texts us. He still texts me now and then.
Is that right?
Yeah. There's a bonus episode where I interviewed Ahmad.
Oh, okay.
And got a bunch of his other stories that didn't make it into the podcast. Also, mind-blowing stories.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to talk about, I wanted to ask him about the price he paid. You know, it's not all sort of international hijinks and bravado.
Well, he's in hiding.
To this day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the price he paid and the price his family paid for what he did. So I did that interview. But for the most part, the interviews were already in place. This podcast is an adaptation of a TV documentary by a company called Left Right for the History Channel.
Mm-hmm.
It's called The Road to 9/11, and it aired, I think, 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Really well made, very interesting. For whatever reason, I think they aired it on one of the anniversaries, and it didn't get much of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to redo it as a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And we have thoroughly redone it. We've made it original. It's nothing like the TV documentary. It's a podcast. We've taken advantage of the medium where you have the voice in your ear speaking to you from in the first person instead of this omniscient third-person narrator.
Yeah, no. I'll say it again. Your voice taking us through this is so refreshing and different. Well, you thought I was going to go someplace else?
No, that's exactly what I want to hear.
Like, it's not the sort of the pompous, omniscient, narrator.
None of that.
No. You just your style. You're talking, explaining it to somebody. Is there somebody that you have in mind that you're talking to when you're doing these? These sort of narrations.
It's always like, so I did it right here at this desk.
Yeah.
Into this microphone.
Yeah. Ooh, that's a great mic.
Yeah, it eventually got. Oh, sorry. Let's see. So when I'm sitting here, at all hours of the day and night, I'm not necessarily picturing someone, but it's always the thing of you're at the bar, you're with your pal. And you just want to say, listen, I found out this crazy thing.
Mm.
Or this, listen, this is what happened. You wouldn't believe. So this guy from Egypt went undercover. Let me tell you about it.
Mm.
That's sort of the tone.
Yeah. No, it is.
That's the tone. And in the writing, there's a lot of information. So you have to make it very clean and clear. And you have to dole it out in a way so as not to overwhelm the listener.
Mm. Yeah, very. Yeah. I mean, the cast of characters in this is immense, but you just a masterful job in, like, sort of giving a single line. Of, you know, well, we heard him in episode one when he did this and blah blah blah. Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
I totally appreciate it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Rather than assuming everybody has this deep knowledge that you have.
Yeah.
And
no, you can't.
Your job.
Yes, you got to always think of the audience. And speaking of the cast of characters, so it was the makers of the video documentary that this podcast is based who talked to some of the major players in the CIA, in the FBI, in the White House, a childhood friend of Osama bin Laden, someone who fought with bin Laden and the Blind Sheikh in the Afghan War, Arab journalists who knew about the founding of Al-Qaeda and its aims. These are amazing gets as interview subjects, and they got so many of them. So this project started with a wealth of material, just to begin with, and that was a huge advantage. We had to do this whole thing, 9 episodes in 6 months, and without that, it could never have been done. We had they just gifted us this raw tape of these of these interview subjects who were on the inside and who could really speak with insight about what went on. And, you know, as you know, sometimes we're there to cover their ass and blame someone else for things that went wrong. That's part of the story, too.
Mm.
You know, and you're trying to sift who's doing what, who made the right decision, who made the wrong decision. And a couple of times I throw it back on the listener. Okay, what would you do in this situation?
Absolutely.
Under pressure,
mm-hmm.
not knowing what we now know? What would you do? You think it's so easy?
Yeah. And especially there was that one tiny window of time and from the collapse of the Soviet Union to the fall of the Twin Towers where we were sitting on top of the world.
Seemingly, yeah.
Seemingly.
We were spending the peace dividend.
This is before China had, you know, taken all the jobs.
We had no real rival.
There was no rival
when it came to superpowers.
Just complete hegemony.
Well, yeah, we had something of a hegemony in global politics. But it's precisely at that moment when this countervailing force of global militant jihad starts to arise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And America has always been sort of an insular, inward-looking country. You remember the Clinton years. Like, we were worried about domestic issues, right?
Yeah.
You know, and
things that distracted us.
I remember when the missiles were lobbed in Tora Bora, right?
Sudan.
Oh, was it Sudan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sudan. I think we also tried to get him in... Kandahar?
Okay, Kandahar. So,
about
the cruise missiles, you know, you got, you know, Clinton lobbed the cruise missiles there. And everyone is like, oh, man, you know, he's just trying to distract us from the real important issue, which was the blowjob in the White House.
Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Right.
Yeah, conversely, when that scandal is dominating all of Washington, D.C., there's no appetite for, in national security circles, to do something that has a real chance of killing or capturing bin Laden because the president feels like he doesn't have the standing or what have you. It's too weak, too consumed with other things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so bin Laden goes on his merry way.
And again, as you say, this was so far outside our ability to even imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
That, as I said, you know, like, what would you do?
Yeah.
Well, I would have done X, Y, and Z. Who could have imagined?
Yeah, so we're talking about the late 90s now. Yeah. Almost no one could imagine flying planes as weapons into tall buildings and knocking them to the ground. That was almost literally beyond the realm of possibility in our minds. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, by the late 1990s, Al-Qaeda had launched several attacks.
Yeah.
Some of them very serious, including the bombing of our embassies in East Africa. Something like 225 people killed, thousands injured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was clear that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were dangerous and a direct threat to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, we knew we had an enemy, and he was lethal and persistent. On the other hand, we yet could not imagine what was to come.
Yeah. Well, that was the knock on Clinton, wasn't it? That they attacked us, we left. They attacked us, we left.
Well, that was bin Laden's interpretation of the United States.
That
it was a paper tiger like the Soviet Union and
right.
could be bullied into retreat.
You're listening to Foraging Ahead on WGXC 90.7 FM, Egret, Catskill, Hudson, a lot of other towns. I'm Kevin Factor, and this is the last part of my interview with veteran journalist Jim O'Grady on his podcast, Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11. The whole series is out. I can't recommend it enough. It is a nice break from the current stress that we're undergoing because it's terrifying. But it's not about the elections. In this last segment, I asked Jim what he learned from researching all this that he was surprised, and where he thinks the country is headed, and why do we need to listen to this now? Why produce a podcast on 9/11? And he also leaves me with some basic journalistic radio interview tips. Always happy to have them and get them from an old pro like Jim. What have you learned from this experience? And what should we learn from this experience?
The United States is still a superpower. That much hasn't changed since 9/11. With great power comes responsibility. And as the United States pursues its interests around the world, it makes enemies. It's still doing that. Mm. So this has not gone away. Mm. I was struck in the episode about sort of the history of the Twin Towers themselves and how they came to symbolize sort of international commerce and capitalism. Mm. How monopolies invite dissent. If you're a country that seems to have a monopoly on global power and or financial power, forces will arise to try to take you down. Mm. That's what we saw in this story. And to think it's not still happening is naive.
I was going to ask, so it seems like the war on terror is kind of on the back burner now.
Well, yeah, our daily news cycle is so overwhelming. It's sort of like during the Lewinsky scandal.
That's what I'm thinking.
It's blotting our current circus of national political life. It just blots out the sun. And there's no other issue that can be considered, seemingly. So, yeah, you just hope that the intelligence professionals are doing their job. And you hope that the people who make foreign policy remember that it's soft power that is long-lasting, mm-hmm. and gains friends and doesn't just produce enemies like hard power does.
Why do we need to hear this story of 9/11 now?
Well, 19 years have passed. We're going to come up on the 20th anniversary next year. It's as good a time as any to look back and reflect on what happened and why, and what that means for us now, and how we can be better prepared for the next time, and there will be a next time. 9/11 is the Pearl Harbor of our time, you know, and attacks on the United States did not end with Pearl Harbor, obviously, and they won't end with 9/11. To me, what makes the story interesting is the workings of government, of spy agencies, and Security Council meetings at the White House, and agents on the ground in Pakistan and Afghanistan, trying to understand the world and our relationships with other countries and other movements, and all that comes into play in the story. We know it because of the people directly involved, and this podcast is based on a TV documentary that interviewed so many of those people. They spoke candidly. I think they did speak candidly because enough time has passed from the event itself that they can be more or less honest about what happened and their role in what happened. And we need to get them now before too much more time passes and memories start to seriously erode and people are no longer with us. So I think now is the right time to have gathered that material, and now is the right time to tell the story. I hope people listen to it, to the podcast, from now until the 20th anniversary and through the 20th anniversary. There's a lot to understand. And also, it's just a great story. really, that's my first answer. It's a great story told by the people who were there, and why not tell a great story? A lot of people have said to me, you know, I thought I knew this story, and I relate to this because I thought I knew this story, but I was surprised by so many things that came up in the course of the podcast, and I was surprised in researching the podcast and reading the transcripts of the interviews of Leon Panetta, former CIA director and White House chief of staff, of top leaders at the CIA and the FBI, and as I said this before, of people who knew Osama bin Laden personally, of a guy who infiltrated a terror cell in New York and New Jersey. These people have knowledge and information and insight that you can't get from anyone else. That's what I would say. Also, Kevin.
Yes.
It's free. The podcast is free.
Thanks so much for sitting down and talking to me about your amazing podcast.
Thank you, Kevin.
And all the hard work that you do.
Thank you so much.
Behalf.
Do you want to introduce me? Like, I'm here with Jim O'Grady. Or and ask me to, like, ID myself?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you do to start out a segment?
I could do that.
Because we just skipped over that. We just went right into the conversation.
Yeah, I know.
Something I often do when I'm interviewing people. Well, but we don't have to. I just wanted to mention it.
Well, like, I'm here with Jim O'Grady, overlooking the Hudson.
Yeah. In room 2 of the Saminsky Insky.
Mm-hmm.
Tivoli, New York.
Oh, no, no.
Can't do that?
No, no, no. I don't want anybody else moving here.
Okay. Yes.
I took Gary Steingart to task about an article he wrote about Germantown.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, dude.
Shh. Okay, let's say at an inn in the Hudson Valley.
An undisclosed location.
Yes.
Yes. I'm sitting with a journalist, actor, writer,
yeah.
Jim O'Grady, storyteller extraordinaire.
Thank you.
And we're going to be talking about his new podcast from WNYC,
mm-hmm,
and the History Channel,
mm-hmm,
called Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11.
That's right. Thank you, Kevin. It's great to be here with you today.
You want to give me a little bio, or should I give you a bio?
Oh, yeah. Well, you introduced me very well. Yeah. I'm a reporter and a host at WNYC,
mm-hmm,
and the podcast is a collaboration between WNYC,
mm-hmm,
Studios,
mm-hmm,
and the History Channel, which,
mm-hmm,
is now known as History.
History, right. And so how is covering this major event, 9/11, different from, I think, probably the first one you did, which was the explosion of the battleship of Maine? In Havana, Cuba.
Yeah. Well, that's when I became a veteran reporter. I learned my craft by following Marco Polo into China.
McKinley called for volunteers, and then I got my gun. First Spaniard I saw coming, I dropped my gun and run. It was all about that battleship, man. Now why are you running? Are you afraid to die? The reason I am running is because I cannot fly. It was all about that battleship, man. At war with that great nation, Spain. When I get back to Spain, I'm gonna honor my name. It was all about that battleship, man. I give my feet good exercise, I had nothing else to do. It was all about that battleship, man. Well, they chased me all through Cuba, and I thought I'd lose my life. If I go back to Mobile, I'll send my darling wife to fight for that battleship, man. At war with that great nation, Spain. When I get back to Spain, I'm gonna
First thing I cast my eyes upon was a great big pot of peas. It was all about that battleship Maine. Well, the peas, they were greasy, and the meat, it was fat. The soldiers fighting the Spaniards, and I was fighting that. It was all about that battleship Maine. At war with that great nation, Spain. When I get back to Spain, I'm gonna honor my name. It was all about that battleship Maine. Tell me what kind of shoes do the Rough Riders wear? Buttons on the sides cost 5 1/2 a pair. It was all about that battleship Maine. And what kind of shoes do the old farmers wear?